The amount of time we lose at work watching cat videos on the internet should be all the indication we need that we love animals, but not always in the way the animals need. Today's guest knows that well and works hard to get people to treat animals humanely, regardless of the final plans for those animals. Wayne Pacell is the boss at the Humane Society of the United States, president and CEO. His work is known far and wide, and his writing is prolific, too. He's published articles in Foreign Affairs and major magazines, and he's the author of a previous book, the best-selling The Bond, Our Kinship with Animals, Our Call to Defend Them. His new book is called The Humane Economy, Animal Protection 2.0. Wayne Pacell, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Glad to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start about halfway through the book when you take up the SeaWorld story. The events of a few weeks ago must have the Humane Society over the moon.
Well, it was a long time in coming. We had been big critics of SeaWorld really for a quarter century. And for 3 months, I was in closed-door discussions with the CEO of SeaWorld. And frankly, it was enabled by the power of a documentary called Blackfish that began to run serially on CNN. And it really upended the company. It dropped their stock from the upper 40s to the high teens. And a million people decided they're going to take their entertainment needs and their family entertainment elsewhere. The company was in crisis. And we announced together with SeaWorld that it would really upend the thinking of the company and put animal welfare as a centerpiece of its thinking. And it's part of the march of progress that we're seeing in different sectors of the economy. And we're seeing what I call the humane economy forming right before us.
Where you really get an operation that you're targeting where it lives. I mean, when you start having things like the stock price drop, as happened with SeaWorld, that really does cause some concern.
And, you know, after we made the announcement on March 17th, we did all the morning shows in New York and we were on the evening news. The stock price is up 25%. So that really reminds people that these questions of animal protection matter and that companies that aren't building animal welfare into their operational plan are at risk, and those that are factoring in have opportunities. And we're seeing this in the food sector. We're seeing it in wildlife management. We're seeing it in fashion. You know, 2 days after we announced the SeaWorld agreement, we announced that Armani, the legendary fashion company, is going to exclude fur from all of its lines. I mean, that's a big development in the world of fashion as a luxury brand.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, overall, how much would you say the world of animal treatment has changed in just the last few
decades? Well, you know, my book, when my colleagues at the Humane Society of the U.S. read my manuscript, many of them said, my God, we can't believe so many of these gains have been, you know, rolled up into one place or that they exist. And so many of them have frankly happened in the last 3 or 4 years. In the last 6 months, we've had 120 major announcements from food retailers, starting with McDonald's in September, and then earlier this month, Walmart, saying they're not going to buy eggs from farms that confine the hens in battery cages. Now, it's going to take them a little while to phase this in, but they've made the public decision and they've made the corporate decision that they're not going to be associated with the sort of cage confinement of animals. It's so severe, it'd be like me and you and six other guys in a small elevator, and we never get out. I mean, the animals cannot move. And it's one thing to raise animals for food and consume them or their products, their reproductive products like milk or eggs. It's another thing to make their lives every day a living hell. And I think things got so bad in industrial ag that we forgot that these animals have needs and feelings. And my book is really, I think, a chronicle of how things are rapidly changing and consumers and their awareness of these issues are driving the change.
Now, not all of this, you point out, is intentionally about helping animals when it comes in the form of corporate decision-making. What do you mean?
Well, you know, I mean, the big historical example is what happened in our country to the horse. I mean, before the internal combustion engine, horses were the main means of transport for people and for goods, other than, you know, on rivers and barges and the like. Land transport was based on animals. It wasn't an intentional design to create an automobile to protect the horse. It's just that it was more efficient, and there were innovators and technologists who took the steps to create that new technology that then obviated the need for the horse for common transportation. There are so many other innovations like computer-generated imagery in filmmaking. Now, the purpose of CGI was not to free the animals and prevent abuse on the set. It was to make filmmaking more vivid. It was to be more efficient in terms of cost. And, you know, I talked, and I recount this in my book, to the movie director, Darren Aronofsky, who did the movie Noah. Now, there's no movie that has a higher degree of difficulty in terms of representing animals than Noah, because you need two of everything. You can't go to an animal actor, you know, company to get all of the animals of the world, but you can look to CGI. It's much more vivid, it's much better, yet animals are still at the center of the story, and it's one of the examples of technology really allowing us to get past traditional forms of animal use and even exploitation.
Wayne Pacelle is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States and author of The Humane Economy, Animal Protection 2.0, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's John in Grants Pass, non-grumpy. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for that. Two things. Your comment, first of all, I remember my mom growing up as a kid, she wore furs, and she even had one where the head was still on it. What were people thinking in those days? That just seems so, I mean, I understand the pioneers had to, you know, to keep, they would obviously wear furs, but I don't get that. Second question, though, about you. You mentioned about the chickens going free. Well, I read a story, though, about in Texas where there's a half a dozen coyotes every square mile, and they said letting the chickens out is just ringing the dinner bell. So there are practical sides to that. But anyway, two questions. What were people thinking about the furs, and what about the free range with the coyote?
All right, thanks for that, John.
Yes, no, it is startling to see some of our customs, and we look back on them. Sometimes, you know, you see these documentaries on CNN, you look back at the 70s or the 60s, you think, what were these people doing? How they dressed themselves? Were we dressing like that? For those of us who are old enough to have lived in those times. And, you know, it is incredible. In the early part of the 20th century, I mean, the millinery trade involved having whole birds on women's heads. And it was a market-based reform, a campaign to protect birds that ended that.
That actually became a major point of discussion about the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge because it was heavily involved in that back in the day.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, times change, and part of it is just the march of progress, the evolving fashions, but also this moral and ethical view that animals matter. And I think that's part of it. And, you know, today with fur, Armani and Hugo Boss and other companies that traditionally relied on it, they can now turn to technologists who can replicate the style and function of fur without any of the animal cruelty. On the point about the chickens and the coyotes, I mean, obviously predators in so many parts of the country, certainly in southern Oregon and in northern California, are part of the landscape. So farmers have to be attuned to those issues. Many of the cage-free operations for egg production keep the animals inside in barns. And some of them that do allow access to pasture, they have the animals out during the day, and then they go in at night to roost. So even the most free-range operations can do predator protection activities without killing the predators that lead to good outcomes for consumers as well as for the birds.
You mentioned battery cages before. Those provide electric shocks, is that right?
You know, the battery cages are actually, it's funny, it's like a battery of cages, one after another. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't relate to any any energy, but it's a long row of cages, and I should have explained this, I apologize. So the cages are side by side, and they're stacked one on top of the other, and they jam six or eight birds in the cage, and the ethical issue is that the birds are crammed together. They're just jammed so tight that they can't move. And that's where the Humane Society of the U.S. and other groups have said, hey, if we're going to conduct agriculture, the very least you can do is allow animals built to move, to have wings that flap and legs that move, and they're disabled in all practical terms in these confinement cages.
It's interesting to note, as you do in the Humane Economy, Wayne, that the pressure point often is not in applying to the people who deliver the product in the first place, in this case the eggs or the chickens, but provide the pressure to the store chains. That seems to be at least as effective, if not a whole lot more.
Well, that's a really, really astute point. You know, the producers are sometimes, you know, really steeped in this, and they've been doing things a long way, and, you know, they're good people, but that's just been the convention in the industry. The retailers, like a Walmart, I mean, they're selling thousands and tens of thousands of products, so they're not dependent on, you know, that producer to get this product to them, to the extent that say, hey, we're going to take anything you got. So the Walmarts of the world have been tremendously progressive in terms of their use of energy. They've changed their truck fleets. They have more fuel-efficient vehicles. They've produced lighting that's more efficient. Now they're getting into animal welfare, and they're basically telling their suppliers, hey, we'll give you some time, but you've got to get out of this cage confinement business. You've got to give us cage-free eggs. That is a wholly positive development for the world. And frankly, it's going to position those producers for success in the future, because as their market leaves them, if they're clinging to these cages, there's not going to be any left for them, anyone left to sell the eggs if they don't get with the program.
So I hadn't thought to ask this question until now. Is it easier to make the point economically than it is politically? Because you sure can get caught up in politics. Witness the, you know, because we're talking about Walmart and pork, for example. But you got Chris Christie vetoing a bill that would have taken pigs out of confinement cages in New Jersey, probably to impress the voters in Iowa, where he was trying to win a primary.
Absolutely. I mean, he was pandering to Iowa pork producers, but in reality, if Chris Christie had done polling about the issue, he would have found out that most Iowans actually don't like the cage confinement. When you've got companies like Walmart and McDonald's and Cracker Barrel and Sonic, which is based in Oklahoma City, I mean, mainstream middle American, you know, companies based in the heartland are saying, we don't want any part of this. The world is moving on, but you're right. I mean, sometimes the politicians are the ones who lag. And on the issue of food and agriculture, the corporations, specifically the food retailers, have been in the forefront. The politicians will eventually catch up when they have to, but there have not been any profiles and courage, you know, for the whole of Congress. You've got a number of congressional leaders who are outstanding on these issues, but the ag committees are still dominated by lawmakers from areas where the special interest big agribusiness folks have so much inordinate influence. This is a classic case example. We reached an agreement with the Trade Association for the Egg Industry to have more humane housing systems for laying hens, a minimum welfare standard. So we had the key party representing basically every egg producer in the nation supporting this agreement, and the Humane Society of the U.S., the biggest, you know, voice in animal welfare in the U.S., and the Congress thwarted it because the pork and cattle industries didn't want to see any animal welfare standards enshrined into federal law. So that's when we went to the corporations, and now we've run the table with 120 of the biggest names in food retail who said no cage confinement at all. So it's actually a stronger standard for the birds than what the Congress was even contemplating.
We have an email from Ann in Grants Pass who says, I have been an animal advocate and have worked with animals in various settings over 40 years. I'm thrilled how the world is changing to a more compassionate place to live for our non-human animal kin, because humans are animals too. Hopefully, factory farms will be extinct in my lifetime, writes Ann. She writes, much of this is due to the hard work of the Humane Society. Thank you. I recently met a man who works in your wildlife division. I'm blanking on his name. He's one of the most dedicated humans I know and has even risked his life fighting for a better life for wildlife everywhere. Thanks much to him, too. So from Ann in Grants Pass.
Oh, that's awfully nice. You know, we've got a wonderful horse sanctuary in Douglas County in Oregon, in the city of Oakland, where we have rescued horses that came out of the Premarin industry. That this industry, which was based in North Dakota and in the prairie provinces of Canada, was basically milking horses, pregnant horses, for their urine. And that was the product in pregnant mare's urine, Premarin, which is an estrogen replacement drug. But it was found that substance had a connection to breast cancer. The market declined. All these horses, you know, were going to be sent to slaughter, and we've got about 200 of them at our horse sanctuary called the Duchess Sanctuary in just outside of Roseburg.
Let's talk about, we only have time for about one more question here, the ways in which those of us who are interested in influencing markets can do things. But, for example, I mean, we want to see the elephant survive, but we don't buy ivory anyway. I mean, what can we do about a situation like that?
Well, that's where you have policies, and right now we're actually circulating an initiative petition in the state of Oregon to put a measure on the ballot for November 2016, so the general election when you'll vote for president, to stop the trade in ivory, rhino horn, and 10 other species and taxa of endangered animals, because the United States and China and the big wealthy nations are the ones that are consuming, sometimes unwittingly, these products. Some people think, oh, it's an alternative, or, you know, the animal just died and they took the ivory from it. So we have a role to play, and we'd love to get people involved in that ballot measure.
A whole lot to think about in the book, The Humane Economy, Animal Protection 2.0. Wayne Pacell is the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States and its author. Thank you so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, take care.